It's time for Forward Nation Radio. Now here he is, the host of Forward Nation Radio, David Leventhal.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Forward Nation Radio. Thank you for joining us. On today's show, we'll start off with the news, some discussions of hate, we'll answer some listeners' questions, and a discussion of campaign finance, and perhaps more if we have some time. If past history is any guide, we're not going to have any more time. I'd like to start off first. We are not starting off with a story about Russia and the Russia connection. Unfortunately, we are starting off with a serious and sad story of famine and drought in Somalia, Yemen, and two other countries that most Americans couldn't find on a map. According to relief agencies, more than 20 million people are in danger of starvation or dying of thirst. What does that mean to us? It has, well, from a humanitarian perspective, we should care. It puts Trump's idea of cutting foreign aid in a rather harsh light. But even if we're not moved by humanitarian concerns, even if the fact that these people do not share most of our color, our religion, our language, just for self-interest, we should consider doing more to help than we are already doing. We read this story in the context of stories of how many civilians we are now killing in Syria, Iraq, and other places where we are fighting the Islamic State. Apparently, our view of beating terrorism is we're going to bomb everyone into submission. It is clear from history that that is not going to work. We are not going to bomb our way free of terrorism. And clearly, one of the ways we're going to have to fight to get through terrorism is to win the hearts and minds of the people around the world, to respect America, to, if not love us, honor us for our commitment to making a better planet. The fact that we, in many respects, are now moving in the opposite direction gives more reason for people to dislike us. Stories like this in Somalia and elsewhere are only going to become more common because of something called climate change. That's right, climate change. It exists. Science exists, despite what the current administration and the current Republicans running this government would have you feel. It is only going to get worse. We can't attribute any one particular instance to climate change. We can't attribute this drought to climate change and our impact on the planet. But in aggregate, these things are going to be getting worse. And we are going to bear a huge responsibility for it. Until recently, the United States, and for a long time, the United States was the number one climate change polluter on the planet. We have been eclipsed now by China, but that's a little unfair because China's the world's number one climate change emitter, in part because they're making all of our stuff. If Americans want to drive around in their big SUVs and build their big McMansions for their families of four, you can understand why the rest of the world may grow to resent us. The question now, and probably the question for the future, is not why do they hate us and why do people try to hurt us? The relevant question is probably, why don't more people hate us? Why aren't more people trying to hurt us? Maybe we should engage in behaviors that try to lessen that rather than increase it. On a lighter note, our second story is a cold case murder story. Murder mystery that appeared in the New York Times. And when I say cold case, I'm talking very, very cold. A murder mystery 5,300 years old. In case you missed the story of Utsi, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, a well-preserved mummy found on the northern Italy. Found 25 years ago because global warming to that point had made glaciers recede and a body that had been flash frozen for over five millennia suddenly got exposed and found. It was a fascinating story about how science, oh, there's that dirty word again, science, about how science is managing to discover things about this 5,300-year-old man that are simply remarkable, including piecing together the facts surrounding his murder. Republicans have responded to this not by increasing their calls to promote science, as opposed to take away from science, cut science funding. No, Republicans actually have come out and called for an investigation of Hillary Clinton's role in the murder. That's not true, but it could be. One other part of that story that I thought was pretty interesting, it turns out that Otzi was found and he had a Snicker bar in his pocket, and the Snickers bar had not yet reached its expiration date. So there's a call out for Snickers. Okay, our next story is about Russia. There have been protests against the rule of Vladimir Putin. Somewhat shockingly, those protests are not occurring in the United States. No, in fact, those protests of the rule of Vladimir Putin are occurring in Russia. Good luck to the protesters who are already being arrested, and who knows what else. In America, what's the latest on the Russian role in our recent election? Well, the House Intelligence Committee has certainly covered itself in glory. Its chairman, Devin Nunes, came out and immediately showed that he was a shill for Donald Trump. Came out and violated his own committee procedures. It was almost comical how he ran to the Trump administration for advice on what to do and how to bury the story, how to bury investigations and to support Trump's unsupported and unsupportable allegations that Barack Obama was wiretapping him. Just a day later, he had to retract everything he said as he tried to change the focus of the investigation from Russia's role in our election, from people within the Trump administration and Trump transition team lying about their contacts with Russia and Russian agents prior to the election, to the issue of leaks. Now, some people find it ironic that the Republicans are making hay about the issue of leaks as opposed to a possible rival foreign power's role in undermining our election. Their focus is on leaks. And how did they change the discussion to leaks? By citing leaks. Anonymous leaks, one after another. Someone told me this, I can't tell you who. Well, it turns out that someone was at the White House. And he dutifully, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, dutifully took the White House leaks and brought them back and spoke to the press without speaking to anybody on his committee. How much more evident does it need to be that this man is completely unqualified to be leading hearings into his supporter, his boss, Donald Trump, and his administration? The one good thing about the Republicans on this issue is as much as they try to cover things up, they keep shooting themselves in the foot through their incompetence. Shooting themselves in the foot, one would presume, with a Kalashnikov. I'd like to talk briefly about leaks. In one sense, the Republican position on leaks is not necessarily that hypocritical. I'd like to break leaks down into sort of two broad types. The one leak, Daniel Ellsberg, Edward Snowden. Leakers who speak truth to power, who reveal information that the powers that be do not want revealed, who share information that the American public needs to have so that we can make better and more informed decisions and hold our government accountable. These are the leaks that most of us find laudable. These, of course, are not the leaks that the Trump administration finds laudable. There's another type of leak, and that's the leak that we see in this particular case. And that is when the powers that be, the administration in charge, leaks information to get it out into the public without any accountability for its truth or falseness. There is no accountability when you spread lies through leaks and your minions dutifully share them with others. You are not responsible for spreading falsehoods. These leaks, of course, are far more problematic. These are the ones that the Republicans tend to utilize. This puts me in mind, great example, after remembered this when I'm reading about the story. During the run-up to the Iraq War, the Bush administration was leaking information about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Turns out what they were leaking was bullshit. They were lying. And how were they doing these leaks? Well, in large part, they were doing these leaks because the vice president's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, was fucking a New York Times reporter, Judith Miller. And pillow talk, literally, involved Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Judith Miller was then taking this information that she was getting from her lover and printing it in the New York Times. Turns out the information was false. It was ultimately uncovered what her role was. In fact, she was not even supposed to be working on the story. And ultimately, completely discredited the journalistic bona fides of Judith Miller, ending her journalistic career. By ending her journalistic career, of course, I meant she suffered the same fate that many people who have no credibility and no journalistic credentials whatsoever suffer. And that is, she went to work for Fox News. Okay, the healthcare vote. Am I cheering? Yes, I'm not ashamed to admit it. I am cheering. It's not that I'm rooting for the Trump administration to fail. It's that I'm rooting for them to fail when they're attempting to implement policies that are going to harm this country and most of the people in it for the benefit of the top 0.1%. And this was true of the Republican health care plan, Trump Care, or the American Health Care Act. What was interesting is how this went down, and there's something for all of us to learn from this. As much as they tried to put pressure on Republican congresspersons, twist their arms, threaten, cajole, basically give them everything they want by changing a bill that nobody really was invested in anyway, changing the bill however people wanted it to be done so that they had a chance of actually passing it. There's no policy involved here. It was all politics. But it turns out 15 members of the ultra-right-wing Freedom Caucus refused to jump on board. A principled stand, not against the fact that the bill was going to deny health care for 24 million people who currently have it, but because it wasn't going to deny health care to enough people. Whatever, the Republicans couldn't really threaten the Freedom Caucus, as we've talked about in prior weeks, because of the way elections work in the House and gerrymandering. The Republicans can't threaten with running someone to the right of Freedom Caucus members in a primary. There's nobody to the right of Freedom Caucus members. They're the ones who chased out the so-called moderates before by being crazier than they were and winning the Republican primaries. It's pretty hard to threaten people when you really don't have much to threaten them with. There's not much that you could threaten them with as far as government action, because basically they don't believe in government. There's not really much that they want. Maybe the more interesting part here was the Republicans who were so-called more moderate, who wouldn't flip on the bill. And here I think the important lesson is the role of activism. I think that clearly this is a case where people screaming loudly and clearly changed behavior in Congress. Not that they particularly were moved, as you might have guessed, I have a pretty low opinion of them. Not that I expect they were moved by all the stories of people at town hall meetings about family members who were going to die once the Republicans repealed Obamacare and replaced it with Trump care. Whether or not they were moved by those stories, they were at least moved enough by the number of people protesting, the number of people screaming, the number of people angry, that they actually felt that if they switched on that position, they might get voted out of office. I would argue that this is an exciting and all too rare case of democracy possibly working. Okay, we have a couple other stories to finish with on the news. Again, not such happy stories. Florida is expanding Stand Your Ground, the Stand Your Ground law. On the theory, apparently, that not enough black people are being murdered in Florida. So Florida intends to make it easier for people who kill primarily black people to get away with it by claiming that they were afraid, including the, retired police officer who killed a man in a movie theater who threw popcorn at him during an argument. More than two-thirds of people now who claim Stand Your Ground is the reason they killed someone are not charged under Florida law. More than two-thirds of the people they kill are unarmed. Rather than moving in the direction most of us would like to see, just Florida trying to reduce the number of gun-related homicides, they've decided to make it even easier to kill people. One of the people caught up in the rising tide of hatred in this country coming out of the right was right here in New York, a man by the name of Timothy Kaufman. By all accounts, a decent, unprepossessing man, just trying to get by, who was killed by a jackass who came up to New York to kill black people in the media capital of the world. I am Jewish. I was born into a Jewish family. My last name is Leventhal, you might have guessed that. I was born into a Jewish family. My grandparents kept kosher households. I do not follow the religion, but I still consider myself a Jew. Being married to a Catholic, practicing Catholic, I remind my children when they come home from church on Sunday that they're Jews. I do that in part to honor my ancestors. I do that in part because of the pride of the Jewish experience, the Jewish political experience in America. Jews have always been a liberal voting bloc. They have fought for civil rights. They have fought on behalf of black people. Queens College student who was Jewish was one of the three civil rights workers who famously died in Philadelphia, Mississippi, fighting for civil rights. I am proud that 71% of Jews, more than any other religion, voted for Hillary Clinton. That being said, 24% of Jews voted for Donald Trump. 24% of Jews voted for an authoritarian, totalitarian, demagogic bigot. A man promoting bigotry, discrimination, hatred in his run for the presidency. I ask my fellow Jews, 24% of you, when did never again become, all right, we'll give it at least one more shot. When did your tax cuts, your government involvement in paying for your religion, your so-called love of Israel, as if only one political party supports Israel, when did that trump the idea that we need to fight to make sure that what happened in the 1930s and 1940s in Europe never happens again? I know I am sometimes considered and will be considered now a self-hater. Don't really understand that term. I don't hate myself. I don't even hate the 24% of Jews who voted for Donald Trump. But I don't understand it, and I'm discouraged by it. And I think your ancestors and those of our ancestors who died in the Holocaust are turning over in their graves right now. Okay, on a lighter note, let's go to listener questions. We've got a couple of listener questions here that I'd like to get to. First off, from Cindy on Long Island, is there really any way to get rid of the Electoral College? Can we really amend the Constitution to get rid of the Electoral College? And the answer is yes and no. We cannot amend the Constitution to get rid of the Electoral College. It's not going to happen. Just realistically, it's not going to happen. But we don't need to amend the Constitution to get rid of the Electoral College. It turns out that you have no right to vote for President of the United States under the United States Constitution. States can decide how their electoral college, how their electoral votes are apportioned on their own. And if they decide to make it by coin flip, which candidate can spit the furthest, if that's duly passed by the legislature and signed by the governor, that is how the state's electoral votes would be awarded. And that would not violate the Constitution, as strange as that is to think. But that is the way it is. That's what would happen. So all you really need to do is get states comprising a majority of electoral votes, 270, to all pass laws that say our electoral votes will be awarded to whoever wins the nationwide popular vote for president. And once a majority of states, or a majority of states comprising a majority in the Electoral College, once those states pass such a law, then whoever wins the national vote, national popular vote for president, would win a majority of the electoral votes for president and would become the president of the United States. There is a movement underway to do that. In fact, states comprising 165 electoral votes have already enacted such measures. We are only 105 votes away. Go to nationalpopularvote.com, call your congressperson, and register your desire to have your state join the crowd. Those of you in New York or California needn't bother. Your states have already signed up. Jessica from Malvern asks, why are wedge issues even allowed in campaigning? And do you think wedge issues played a large role in Trump's win? Wedge issues are when a political party understands that the supporters of its opposition party are split on a particular issue. And they can hammer at that issue to drive a wedge between the voters of the opposite party. Theoretically, there's nothing wrong with that. I think the problem here, well, I guess there's a couple of problems. One, it's misused. But the biggest problem here is that people allow themselves to be so divided by wedge issues, to be one-issue people. If there's something you disagree with Hillary on, you're going to ditch Hillary? In a civilized society, voters would understand that they're not going to agree with their candidate on everything. and they're going to vote for the better of the candidates, and then they're going to work to change that candidate's mind or move that candidate in the direction they want that candidate to go. The reason that wedge issues and pushing wedge issues is so effective right now in America is because voters are not up to the task of being informed enough and thoughtful enough to make good decisions and understand when they are being divided on issues that may matter to them, but clearly aren't the entire panoply of issues. Do I think that wedge issue played a large role in Trump's win? That's a great question, and I'm not sure how to answer that. Because I don't know, I still, to this date, can't figure out how the hell Trump won and how the hell anybody voted for him. It's hard to imagine, though, that that was such a big issue. Are there really Democratic voters who felt that Hillary wasn't strong enough on a particular issue that they decided to go with Trump? That's a scary thought. I'm sure there were such people. I know we hear stories about the Bernie Sanders voters who defected and voted for Trump. I hope there aren't as many as some people like to say. But I guess the bottom line is, if you're that easily drawn away from your candidate to somebody like Trump, to a clown like that, there's something else going on that's beyond the wedge issues. Okay, I'd like to move on to our main topic today, topic of campaign funding. I've been saying for a long time that there is no greater issue confronting this country than the issue of campaign funding. And I still sort of believe that, despite the fact that we have some short-term issues that present such an immediate threat, like the idea that we have a lunatic as president of the United States who might tweet into a nuclear war at 3 a.m. or pick a fight with Germany, Great Britain, or any of our other allies, completely isolating this country. But as a long-term issue, we don't fix anything until we fix our campaign funding issues. See if you can identify who said each of the following quotes. Government should curb the excesses of the moneyed interests. I hope we shall crush in its birth the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations. The business of government is to organize the common interest against the special interests being money, you know, the people who are completely running this country right now. The American people have but one instrument which they can effectively use against the colossal combinations of business, and that instrument is the government of the United States. Who condemned the malefactors of great wealth? Who said the rich and powerful too often bend the axe of government to their selfish purposes? If you guessed, in order, Thomas Jefferson, Woodrow Wilson, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and Andrew Jackson, give yourself a prize. In another vein, who said, politics is as much a regular business as the grocery or the dry goods or the drug business. That was corrupt Tammany Hall, leader, corrupt political organization in New York, early in the last century, George Washington Plunkett. Who said there are two things that are important in politics? The first is money, and I can't remember what the second one is. That was a guy by the name of Mark Hanna, who was the chairman of the Republican National Committee during William McKinley's 1896 campaign. And finally, who said, an honest politician is one who, when he is bought, stays bought. That was Simon Cameron, a Pennsylvania political boss and senator, and briefly a member of Abraham Lincoln's cabinet. Many of you, I assume, know that there is one president in the history of the United States who was forced out of office before his term expired. That, of course, was Richard Nixon. You know Watergate, you know the term, you may not be familiar with the specifics. What you're probably not familiar with is that Watergate was, at bottom, a campaign funding scandal. The dirty tricks played by the Nixon administration were supported by Republican slush funds, money raised, and then sent to an organization deliciously going by the acronym of CREEP, the Committee to Re-elect the President. As a result of a president having to resign in disgrace, in 1974, Congress was moved to try to limit money in politics, having seen its corrupting impact. It passed in 1974 amendments to the Federal Election Campaign Act, designed to limit political spending and political donations. That law was shortly challenged in the United States Supreme Court, in the infamous case Buckley v. Valeo. The United States Supreme Court ruled that campaign spending could not be limited. It did uphold the campaign donation limits in the FECA amendments, saying that even though spending money was a matter of free speech, the threat to democracy was significant enough that reasonable limitations on speech, like preventing people from yelling fire in a crowded movie theater, did not violate the First Amendment. Well, once that law took effect and there were some limits on donations, money looked for a way around the laws. It looked for loopholes. And the first loophole that came up is something called soft money. Soft money is, for those of you who watch The Sopranos, you'd be more familiar with its alternative name, money laundering. The idea of soft money is instead of giving money directly to a political candidate, you filter it through, generally at the time, through national political parties, which then spent it on the candidates. It was not deemed a campaign donation. You spend it on political conventions and other things that the candidate would like. Now, of course, I guess you book the entire Trump hotel for your weekend retreat. But soft money found a way through. At times we tried to close some of those loopholes, but the money still finds a way. Another loophole that came up was something called bundling. The idea of donation limitations where you can't buy a candidate with, under FECA, it was $2,000 for an election. You can't buy a candidate with $2,000. Even back in the 1970s, $2,000 wasn't enough money to buy a candidate. We've since raised those limits, but they're still small enough that you can't buy a candidate by contributing directly on your own. But what you can do is something called bundling, where you get together all your friends and family members, your senile grandmother, your three-year-old triplets, all of whom decide that what they really, really, really want to do is donate the maximum to the political candidate of your choice. Even more perniciously, if you run a business, hypothetically speaking, let's say your name is, I don't know, Ken Lay, and you run a business called Enron. You call your managers together for a meeting, and you walk around the room asking how loyal they are to your company. Do they understand the importance of getting Boy George elected president of the United States and how good that would be for Enron? You put the squeeze on them until they put up the money. Then you gather all those checks and you get to visit the candidate and deliver your basket of checks. Despite the campaign limits, during the Bush campaign, there was a $100,000 level where you got to be a Bush pioneer. If you gave $100,000 or more to the candidate, you got the secret decoder ring, you got the secret handshake, you learned the secret language. Of course, more importantly, you got to sit down with the with the future president of the United States to tell him what it is you want from government. It turns out, however, that $100,000 level didn't keep out the riffraff. There were too many small donors donating $100,000, so the Bush campaign had to come out with a different level, a $250,000 level called Bush Rangers. Texas Rangers, get it? So cute. And there you got several Dakota Ring secret handshakes, dinner with the president. You probably got to play a round of golf, whatever you got for your money. Why can't we limit speech? Or why can't we limit campaign spending? Because of the ruling that it was that spending money is considered speech. As a long-term member of the ACLU and a longtime supporter, I actually go against the organization, which is absolutist on this and believes that we should not be cutting down speech, including political speech. That's the argument against campaign restrictions. This is free speech. Spending money is freedom of speech. Well, what about that free speech argument? How does it work out in the real world? First of all, when considering the free speech argument, you've got to understand, who do most corporations give their money to? And if you guessed Republicans, you'd be right, but you'd only be half right. Most corporations give their money to both sides. Republicans tried to limit that through the K Street Project years ago and other ways, intimidating businesses. But for the most part, businesses give their money to both sides. Doesn't sound like free speech if everybody's representing your interests. Senate Majority Leader Yertle the Turtle used to be in charge of the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee. What made him so powerful was that he controlled the purse strings of all the slush money, the soft money that was donated through the political parties. Years ago, he was made famous. There was a committee of business leaders called the Committee for Economic Development. This committee of business leaders got together to support issues that they commonly agreed on. One of those issues became campaign finance reform. They supported campaign finance reform. This was a threat to Mitch McConnell's power and Republicans' hold on our government. So he dashed off a letter to the members of the Committee for Economic Development saying, campaign funding is a matter of free speech. If you don't agree, you should resign your position immediately. In other words, campaign spending is a matter of free speech, and if you don't agree, you should shut the hell up. This letter became rather famous in some circles because of how it exposed the fact that Mitch McConnell really didn't believe in free speech at all. This was the same man who just a few weeks ago stopped Elizabeth Warren from speaking on the Senate floor, from reading a letter from Coretta Scott King, the widow of famed civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. Stopped her from reading it on the Senate floor. Doesn't exactly sound like a man who believes a whole lot in freedom of speech. When it comes to money, he believes in it. So what is the result of the system we have? Well, the concept of free speech in America is premised on the idea of a marketplace of ideas. In the words of iconic former Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. The idea is to create a marketplace of ideas. Even noxious ideas should be aired because the best way to discredit noxious ideas is to air them. One of the most famous free speech cases in American history was to allow neo-Nazis to march in Skokie, Illinois. The theory being that the best way to discredit neo-Nazis was to allow people to listen to what they had to say and allow people to argue against them. That being said, in Germany, if you deny the Holocaust, you will go to prison. Not in America. We are absolutist on the concept of free speech because of the marketplace of ideas. As political philosopher A.J. Liebling famously said, freedom of the press is guaranteed to those who own one. The problem with free speech now in America is that it is anything but free. People don't speak on street corners anymore. You don't go to Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park in London. That's not the way we get our information. We get our information through mass media. And mass media is very expensive. It's owned by corporations. Commercials are bought by corporations. And we've created a situation where basically only the wealthy can afford to speak in America. This isn't free speech. This isn't a marketplace of ideas. This is propaganda. People don't have the ability to disown noxious ideas, to reject noxious ideas, because they don't have enough information to understand how awful those ideas are. So people who listen to nothing but Fox News and Breitbart can actually think that voting for Donald Trump is a good idea. We are going to need to seriously reconsider how we enforce our free speech rules in this country. Because we are not promoting a marketplace of ideas. We are promoting the interests of the wealthy at the expense of everybody else. The way this plays out in the real world, if I walk into a car dealership and I try to slip under the table a couple $100 to the salesman and I say, this is for you. Give me the lowest price that your company will agree to on the car. I could go to jail. That's bribery. If I do that in the campaign finance, in the political arena, that's also illegal because of the quid pro quo involved, this for that. So I simply learn to hand the money under the table and say, I know you know how important it is that I get a good price for this car, right? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And he responds by saying, oh, yes, and you understand that I, as a politician, understand the importance of local businesses being supported. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. As long as we do that, if we don't make it a quid pro quo, it's free speech. This whole situation was made worse in 2010 with Citizens United that opened up the floodgate to corporate spending on elections. One of the things that could limit the impact of money in politics is if voters get upset that their candidate is selling them out in favor of a big campaign contributor. So what happens is campaign funding is used along with media spending so that I will buy your politician and I will run enough media to confuse you so that you don't even know that I bought your politician. You actually think I'm standing up for you. What is the result of all this? Well, why would a bunch of business executives support campaign finance reform? Well, it turns out these were mostly smaller businesses. A system of bribery has tended to benefit the biggest and wealthiest businesses. Instead of bribery, we now have something called pay-to-play, where in order to have any possibility of getting a government contract, you need to give money. Bribery has become extortion. Small businesses are caught in the middle. How is campaign finance affecting you? Just very briefly, in the last few days, the Trump administration and the Republicans in Congress have taken away your online privacy, something that the big telecommunications companies have wanted. Net neutrality is about to go out the window. The internet, the one possible democratizing area of speech, is going to be changed so that there will be a fast lane for big corporations and a slow lane for people like The Nation magazine and probably yours truly. New industries get the boot, old industries get a pickup. Solar, renewable energy, Trump administration and Republicans don't give a damn about that, mostly because those are emerging companies that aren't rich enough yet to buy politicians. Coal companies, oil and gas companies, industries of the past, take a look at Thomas Friedman's op-ed in today's New York Times. These are the ones we support despite the fact that it is utterly and completely against our own interests. We give billions of dollars in corporate subsidies. Years ago, Public Citizen estimated $125 billion a year in corporate subsidies. We don't address climate change. And we had a great recession. Because in 20 years, from 1989 to 2009, the finance, insurance, and real estate industries, those that were responsible for the financial crisis that led to the Great Recession, spent almost $2.5 billion on politicians. Until we fix this, we can't address the problems facing this country. Okay, that's it for today's show. Thank you for joining us. On next week's show, we will have news again. We will talk a little bit about cults and their role in our society. Thanks for joining us. We hope to see you next week.
You've been listening to Forward Nation Radio with David Leventhal.